The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Well, good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 19th day of June. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. Got a nice show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the actor who portrayed Kevin Costner's father, John Kinsella, in the classic baseball film Field of Dreams. Dwyer Brown will be with us. In the second half, we'll talk to the official scorer at Citi Field and Yankee Stadium and the co-author of the new book, Down on the Corner, Ralph Kiner and Kiner's Corner. Howie Karpin will join us. So sit back and relax. Enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on GBB. Got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, then you can click and give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240, and all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. Well, my first guest in the 1989 film Field of Dreams, he played John Kinsella, the father of Kevin Costner's character. He also played Henry Mitchell in Dennis the Menace Strikes Again in 1998. And he's also appeared in the great film, one of my favorites, Gettysburg. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Dwyer Brown. Dwyer, good evening.
Hey, Bill, you want to have a catch?
Sure. Let's get out there.
Let's do it.
Great to have you with us.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much.
Now, Dwyer, I guess you grew up in Ohio from what I was reading. Were you a baseball fan back then?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I grew up on a farm out in the middle of nowhere, so we played sports year-round because, you know, there wasn't much else to do that didn't resemble work. So my brother and I have a brother who's 14 months older than me, so we pretty much, you know, played whatever sport was in season and, you know, and some that weren't. But, I played Little League Baseball, and, you know, I recount some of the stories in the book because, you know, the first time when I was 5 years old and went out to play baseball, my mom was going to show us how to bat, and she ended up hitting me in the mouth with the bat, and I got 9 stitches. So,
oh boy.
My first experience in baseball wasn't auspicious, but, you know, people tell me that my picture is in the Baseball Hall of Fame, so go figure.
Can't beat that. Now, did you have any favorite teams, any favorite players?
Well, I grew up in Northeast Ohio, so, you know, we kind of followed the tribe a little bit. But, you know, my brother was a big fan of the Detroit Tigers, and, you know, we sort of followed players more. I was a big fan of Roberto Clemente,
mm-hmm.
You know, because he was, you know, close by there in Pittsburgh. You know, so, you know, I've sort of always done that, just sort of there's players or styles of play that I like. I mean, I like teams that play small ball, so, you know, I was a fan of the Royals when they made their run, and the Angels in 2000 and all that stuff. I just like people playing, you know, hustling and playing above their level.
Sure, definitely. Now, before we get to Field of Dreams, Dwyer, I'd like to talk to you about Gettysburg. I'm a bit of a Civil War buff, been down to the battlefield several times.
Well, let's not give away the ending of the Civil War, okay?
We don't want to do that. Let people be surprised at who wins. Your scene, describe your scene a little bit in that film.
Well, I was delivering these main mutineers.
Uh-huh. Okay, now I remember.
Jeff Daniels, yeah. I was just kind of a a jerk Union lieutenant, and and I said something like, you can shoot him if you, for all I care, or something like that. So
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now I remember. Now,
but that was an amazing shoot to be on because we shot that right in Gettysburg on those amazing
battlefields. That's what I was going to bring up. This is the first movie where they allowed filming on the actual battlefield at Gettysburg. Even the reenactment every year in Gettysburg is done outside the town. They don't let anybody on the battlefield. But this movie was filmed actually in Little Round Top, Devil's Den, all around the battlefield. And that must have been sensational.
Well, it was. You know, I mean, for any of your listeners out there who haven't been to Gettysburg, it's pretty amazing. I mean,
you can feel
what went on there, you know, 150 years ago, and it still has that feeling. I mean, there was a lot of lives lost, and you know, it really carries that energy, I think, of that place, you know, even to this day. And it was pretty amazing to have reenactors there, you know, living with nothing more than they had in Civil War days, and you know, and us out there leading, you know, Pickett's Charge and that kind of stuff. It really was a little chilling. You know, all of us, I think, felt that it was pretty intense.
Very good way to describe it, Dwyer. Yeah, it must have been an honor, and it must have been actually sensational to be on that shoot. Now, getting into the great Field of Dreams, the film nominated for 3 Academy Awards, Best Original Score, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Picture. Now, did you work at all with Rod Dedeaux?
Rod was out there, but because... It didn't require me to do much more than play catch.
Yeah.
They didn't have me, you know, with some of the other guys, they had them, you know, kind of work and try to imitate the style, of players from that era, from the, you know, 20s and all that. So that, and, you know, I think they did a great job at that. And, you know, Rod was just fantastic, but I unfortunately didn't get to work with him too much.
For those folks who probably are unaware, Universal Studios brought USC coach, the great Rod Dedeaux, in as a baseball advisor. I think he also had USC alumnus, the former Oriole Don Buford, with him, too.
That's right.
Yeah, to coach the actors. And as Dwyer says, he was just having his famous catch, so he didn't need too much training. Now, the producers didn't originally cast Kevin Costner for the part of Ray Kinsella.
Well, they at the time, baseball movies were a pariah. Nobody in Hollywood wanted to even make them. And Kevin had just filmed Bull Durham,
right?
And you know, that was a big, at the time, people just thought he was crazy, that he was going to spoil all this momentum he had, and so the producers were just sure that he's not going to do a second baseball movie right after doing one, you know, that might have already threatened his career. So they had, you know, feelers out to a lot of people. Even, you know, they had Robin Williams as one of the possibilities because he had just come out with Good Morning Vietnam. But, you know, I think ultimately it was hard to believe, you know, I mean, Kevin Costner hearing voices in a cornfield is unusual. But for, you know, Robin Williams to be hearing voices was, you know, it wouldn't make anybody think twice. So I think they needed somebody to kind of ground that film. And, you know, obviously Kevin was a fantastic choice, and he agreed to do it. He, you know, he obviously loved sports and baseball in particular, and so, you know, it ended up being, you know, a perfect match. I can't imagine anybody else in that role. You know, I've seen the movie a few times now, and there's really something that Kevin does that I don't think there's a lot of actors out there, you know, who kind of carried off the way he is, and you can almost not put your finger on it. I mean, I don't know that he's a great actor, but boy, he sure has a great ability to kind of be a believable down home guy, and gets a lot of comedy out of playing a lot dumber than he is in person.
Exactly. We're speaking to Dwyer Brown tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Now, in the book, Ray seeks out J.D. Salinger, a real writer. Now, he threatened to sue if you use his name, didn't he?
Yeah. I think Bill Kinsella, who wrote the book Shoeless Joe, on which Field of Dreams is based, he took a big chance even putting Salinger in the book. But I think, you know, it was a short story that he'd written. You know, it was only 25 pages long. And, you know, he was a big fan of Salinger, obviously, as many young writers are and were. And he took a chance even putting him in the book. And, you know, from what I understand, Salinger probably wouldn't have had too much chance of causing problems. But I think... you know, Phil Robinson, who wrote and directed the movie, I think out of deference to him, you know, they didn't want to bring him any more misery. And I think the whole Terrence Mann character ended up, you know, working out pretty well.
Sure did, yeah.
Salinger would have been fun, but I think, you know, people would have, you know, second-guessed. You know, I mean, you get an actor to play him, you know, I mean, it's open to a lot of you know, interpretation and controversy. But I think they made a great choice.
You'd miss that whole James Earl Jones soliloquy too, Dwyer.
Oh yes, true. Who could have done that better than him? And most importantly, I would have got the opportunity to meet him, which you know would have made my life smaller for sure.
Definitely. Now, the part of Shoeless Joe Jackson with Ray Liotta. I believe everybody figured that it would be an older guy, someone with a southern accent. Now, Liotta plays that more like a Goodfellas type guy. He's kind of dark, he's kind of scary, and doesn't smile much, no southern drawl, but a kind of sense of danger, which I think they wanted in that character.
Yeah, I think they wanted somebody who, just looking at them, was kind of scary and fascinating, and and Ray Liotta is that. I mean, he was really almost as far from the role as he could be. He certainly didn't bat left-handed, or he's got that that Philly kind of accent that he can't shake. And what to me is what's funny is how well it works. Based on all that, which just says something I think about. When you adapt things and sometimes I think you try to stay true to what's based on rather than kind of, take a chance and let, cause Ray certainly, brought a lot of mystery and kind of, reverence to Shoeless Joe in that show.
Well, not many people look like Shoeless Joe. He wasn't exactly a Cary Grant. D.B. Sweeney didn't really look like Shoeless Joe in Eight Men Out either, which is really true to the era. So I guess Ray could pull it off too. Now, the legendary Burt Lancaster, Dwyer, that you got to work with, he originally turned down that part, didn't he?
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. They'd also offered it to Jimmy Stewart, who turned it down. And, at the time, like I said, baseball movies were really poison, box office poison. And, as it turned out, it was Burt Lancaster's last American film. So, mm-hmm. he was pretty old and his health was failing a little bit. And, you make choices and, in retrospect, it seems, ridiculous that he would have turned down that part because what a great kind of, finale to his life. But I read a chapter in the book about him because, I was a big fan of Burt Lancaster. And, James Earl Jones, I just was beside myself. And I don't have to mention Kevin, who, was more a contemporary of mine, but certainly was doing with his career what I'd hope to do with mine, mm-hmm. So it was really quite a auspicious cast to be paired with.
Most definitely. Now, what I had read is that the interior scenes were shot first, because the cornfield wasn't really ready. It was taking too long to grow. They had to bring in extra irrigation to water the corn to get up to Kevin's height. So that was just one of the pitfalls that took place during production.
Yeah, and it was a major concern. Ordinarily the farmers in Iowa, if it doesn't rain early in the summer, it'll rain late in the summer and everything catches up. But when you're shooting a movie that takes place in a cornfield, it would have looked pretty silly for all of us players to be walking out of corn that was 3 feet high, which is about where it was when I got there. And I was, obviously I'm there for the end of the movie. So they had ordered silk corn stalks, artificial ones from Korea. They had 6,000 of those they were going to send over if they couldn't get the corn to grow. So, when they did start watering it, it got so tall then. When they actually were shooting Kevin in the cornfield, you couldn't see Kevin because the corn was over his head. So they had to build a little platform between the rows so that you could see him over the corn rows in the opening scenes when he's hearing the voice for the first time. So, it was feast or famine for sure on that shoot. And, this was kind of fun for me coming in as an actor, having grown up on a farm. And, I have a lot of these stories in the book because, it's the questions people ask me, and it was one of the most difficult shoots I've ever been on. When you think about what a great movie it ended up being, there was every reason that it could have fallen flat on its face.
Definitely. And then also talking about the agricultural aspects, the grass, they had to bring in sod laying people from Dodger Stadium and the Rose Bowl to create the field, and they ended up painting the grass green, didn't they?
Yeah, they built that field much like it happens in the movie, they had four local baseball teams, high school baseball teams, come in on 4th of July weekend. And, you know, they plowed the corn under really quickly and rolled it out and put on the sod. And, you know, it was so hot that summer, you know, by the second or third day, it was just turned to it was just grass. I mean, it was crispy and brown.
Burnt,
so
yeah.
they called the Dodgers groundskeepers and they said, hey, look, you know, late in the summer, sometimes we just have to paint the grass green. So they went out there with Hudson sprayers and sprayed the whole thing. I mean, you would never know it, but
no.
When we were walking around on that grass and playing catch, it felt like we were walking on Easter grass. You know, you could just hear it going, you know, every step you took. So it's kind of funny, you know, that, you know, that's just something, of course, you'd never know watching the movie, but it was certainly funny for us when we were shooting it.
Sure, I bet. Now, another interesting point I read about Dwyer is the last scene with the headlights coming into the field when you guys are having your catch. That was actually the local folks in their cars flashing their headlights.
Yeah, that was 3,000 local Dyersville, Iowa residents in 1,500 cars. I mean, nowadays that would be the simplest shot you could make in CGI, you know, with computer graphics.
But right.
In those days, they didn't have it, so they literally had everybody lined up on the roads. They had porta potties out there. They had AAA out there in case people's cars overheated. And,
oh boy.
Everybody in their cars was listening to AM radio, and the director was broadcasting through the local AM radio station, telling people, okay, we're going to start, ready, we're rolling. And, you know, so that's how people heard and knew what to do, because they were stretched out literally for 3 miles of country roads. And, you know, the local residents were such good sports that they, you know, they stayed all day out there. You know how it is for shoot a movie. You shoot 10 seconds and it takes you in that particular shot, because we had helicopters and everything else, was an all-day affair.
Boy, oh boy. They cooperated and it worked out nicely. We got Dwyer Brown with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240 from Field of Dreams. Now, looking at back at Burt Lancaster and Frank Whaley, Archie Moonlight Graham, based on an actual character, a real-life ball player, his career took place rather around circa 1905 rather than the 1922 season as it's depicted in the movie. And Terrence Mann interviews a number of people about Doc Graham in the DVD, and actually taken from real articles about the man, isn't it?
Yeah. They it's interesting, the things. I mean, I was surprised when I was doing research for the book that Field of Dreams is considered a fantasy movie. You know, I mean, it makes perfect sense, but I guess because I was in it and I, you know, was charged with making it believable, I just sort of think, yeah, sure, you could build a baseball field and ball players would appear. But, I mean, it is a pretty fantastic premise. But they, you know, Kinsella, when he wrote the book, I think really made it more believable by putting characters like J.D. Salinger and Moonlight Graham, who really existed. So suddenly you're like, oh, but this is true, but this isn't true, and this, you know. And, you know, I think he did a great job of making that more believable. And Phil, of course, you know, just filmed it with, you know, just very straightforwardly so that, you know, it just looks like this is happening on a farm. So, of course, anything that happens on a farm must be real. And, it was quite an experience.
The emotional scene at the end with you and Kevin Costner when he realizes that this is my father here, John Kinsella. And you guys come together. How long did it take to film that scene, Dwyer?
Well, I was hired originally for 3 days. I was supposed to fly from L.A. and be there for 3 days. What ended up, because of the corn and a few other things, I ended up being there for 2 weeks. Basically, they decided to shoot that scene at magic hour, which is the 15 minutes after sunset when there's a, you know, beautiful golden light in the sky. And that was fine, except you really only have 15 minutes to shoot. So we would just shoot a little chunk of it every day. Like I'd ask Kevin, you know, is this heaven? And we'd shoot that a few times, and then, you know, it'd be pretty much dark. And then the next day we'd come back and we'd shoot, turn the cameras around on Kevin, and he'd say, no, it's Iowa. And then we'd go on to the next one. And it took us 2 weeks to get those 5 minutes of film at the end. And but, you know, of course, it did end up looking very pretty. And you know, if there were more clouds in the sky one night than the night before, we couldn't shoot because, you know, it would be in the background and it would make it, you know, look like it didn't happen at the same time. But that's probably the strangest thing about that scene, is that it looks like it happens, you know, in 5 minutes, and in fact it's a couple weeks.
Great story. Now, the shot of the line drive knocking over the bag of baseballs next to Kevin Costner when Ray Liotta is at bat.
Yeah.
That actually was not supposed to happen.
Yeah, that was not scripted, and you know, to Kevin's credit, he dodged the ball, and then you know came up with a great line.
He went with it, yeah.
Yeah, to me, that's one of all those things. Those are one of my favorite moments of the movie because it does look so. I mean, you couldn't have. It would have been very hard to have, to have done that scripted, and it was great that they kept it in the film.
Now, I also read, Dwyer, that Burt Lancaster was unaware that Tim Busfield was actually part of the cast. And he had him fetching stuff for him. Is that true?
Yeah. You know, I mean, all of us were a little intimidated by it. I mean, this is one of the classic movie stars. You know,
and
there really
this is the guy in the surf with Deborah Carr and Here to Eternity. This
totally
is a legend, yeah.
Yeah, there weren't many of those, you know, real studio-era you know, stars left, and all of us, I think, were a little in awe, and it was so hot, and he was, you know, his health was not great to begin with, and, you know, he was a little, you know, he had good days and bad days, let's just put it that way, and, you know, Tim Busfield, like me, grew up with, you know, admiring his movies and doing bad imitations of him, and here he was in front of us, and so, you know, we all just wanted to be near him, you know, and so, when Timothy was just sort of standing around and stuff, he'd said, I need an umbrella, you know,
picture him saying that too. I need an
umbrella.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, it was just great. It wasn't until they sort of, you know, had to be in a scene together at the same time. He's like, what's that the production assistant here doing in my scene, you know? So, anyway, it was really pretty fun for all of us. And Busfield is hilarious. He's just a very funny guy.
Oh, that's a great story. Now, one inaccuracy, though, that I read about Dwyer is that when Shoeless Joe is describing Ty Cobb, asking if he could come back and play, none of us could stand the SOB when he was alive, so we told him to stick it. Actually, Cobb and Joe Jackson were very good friends, and they admired each other.
Yeah, I think, obviously, there weren't too many people who got along with Ty Cobb, but I mean it's true. Even I mean, you know, Babe Ruth and everybody really admired. I mean, they would all say that Joe Jackson was a superior hitter to them. So I think they all had a professional respect and admiration for him. So yeah, but it's such a good line. I mean, who could pass it up?
Did you get to meet Affleck and Damon, or were they unknown at the time?
They were completely unknown. I was. I mean, I wasn't in any of the, obviously, in the Fenway.
In the Boston
stuff,
scenes,
Right. But it was funny when, Phil went on to direct, Phil Robinson, who directed Field of Dreams, directed Ben Affleck in a movie, when he was a movie star. And, and Phil was saying something about this being the first movie they'd done together. And Ben said, well, actually, I was in the movie Field of Dreams. I was a tiny little extra in the tiny corner of Fenway Stadium when they shot those scenes there. So, Eddie, that was a pretty good story.
Yeah, that's another great one. Now, the thing about Ray Liotta, batting right hand, throwing left-handed, the real Shoeless Joe batted left-handed and threw right-handed, but Mr. Robinson was okay with that.
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, I think Phil made some really good choices. He was under a lot of pressure, and I don't think Ray Liotta is a ball player much at all. So to not only have to learn, how to hit with your dominant hand, but then have to learn how to, hit with, to the opposite side and all that stuff was, I just think, I certainly get a lot of comments about that from the hardcore baseball fans who know Jackson is, the premier lefty. But, it wasn't something that made the movie less enjoyable. There were so many ways you could, as you were mentioning earlier, criticize the casting of Ray Liotta as Shoeless Joe.
Mm-hmm.
That I think him batting with the wrong hand was minor. And I think anybody who paying attention to that is the same guys who wouldn't see the baseball players out on the field anyway. Just like,
yeah.
Just like Timothy Busfield.
Exactly.
Character.
Good point, Dwyer. Yeah. Now,
one of the other things I talk about in the book is, it's just the extraordinary thing that the movie has brought into my life since then is over the past 27 years, people come up to me, you know, and they'll look at me and they're like, did I go to high school with you? And I'm like, oh, no, no. And they say, oh, my God, you're the guy from Field of Dreams. And they start talking to me and, you know, dozens of people start, you know, telling me about their dads, you know, and invariably, you know, some of them will start tearing up and telling me, you know, my dad never played catch with me and then he died, or I got in a stupid argument with my dad, you know, just like Ray Kinsella did in the movie, and you know, they just couldn't talk to each other, and so 10 years would pass, and then Field of Dreams came out, and they managed to go get their dad and just said, hey, Dad, don't talk, just come with me, and they went to see the movie, and they managed to put their differences behind them, and, you know, I mean, I'm in airports or tire stores and stuff talking to these people, and I end up hugging them, and, you know,
it's
just been amazing, you know, I mean, that's why I sort of wrote the book in the first place was, you know, to kind of retell those stories. To me, it's sort of like a game of catch, you know, the people that come up to me and told me the stories about their dad, and, you know, my father died unexpectedly 30 days before I went to shoot that movie, so you can imagine how strange it was to be playing a dead father coming back to have a catch with their son just a month after my father's funeral. And it's sort of, to me, it's my way of staying in touch with my dad through everyone else's father who've come up to me. And now I've been going around to baseball games. I've thrown out a pitch at Fenway and Kauffman. I was just at McCoy Stadium in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, last weekend, and playing catch with fathers and sons on the field and, you know, selling my book and, you know, autographing it for people. It's been just an amazing ride, considering it was just 5 minutes of screen time 27 years ago.
Outstanding. Well, tell the folks the name of the book, Dwyer.
It's called If You Build It, and, you know, it's available on my website. It's just dwyerbrown.com, and, you know, it's available on Amazon, too. It's got almost a five-star rating and reviews from New York Times, and, you know, everybody, I mean, a lot of the comments I get now are, you know, how much the book has meant to them. And, you know, between the book and the movie, they're going to start every baseball season reading a book and watching the movie again. And I don't know, it's very heartwarming to me if I could ever, you know, write a book that was anywhere near as emotional and classic as Field of Dreams, I would be very happy. And anyway, it's been really fun. We get inundated this time of year because everybody wants to buy a copy for their dad. So I've been, sending them out, and it's been really a kick.
Amazing. Well, it's great to have you with us, Dwyer, on Father's Day. It's been a pleasure speaking with you about your career, about Field of Dreams. I really thank you for spending part of your Father's Day Sunday with us.
Well, thank you so much, Bill, and I could just say, is this heaven? No, it's Sports Talk 1240.
Exactly.
How's that? There's a plug for you.
Wonderful. Thanks, Dwyer. Dwyer Brown, folks. Next up, we'll talk to author Howie Carpin about his new book. Stay with us, folks.
You are listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240. WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit GustBuster.com and get your GustBuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Father's Day. Hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240. I don't think it's inappropriate to say, with my next guest coming on, to all your fathers out there, a very happy birthday. My next guest has been a sports reporter for over 30 years. He's an accredited official scorer in New York for Major League Baseball. He's co-author of the book Down on the Corner, Ralph Kiner and Kiner's Corner. I welcome into Sports Talk 1240 tonight, Howie Carpin. Howie, good evening.
Hey, Bill. Great to be with you.
Great to have you with us, Howie. Now, you grew up in Pelham Parkway section of the Bronx, played a lot of stickball and sandlot baseball, but you're a Yankee fan.
Yep. Well, you know, it goes back to my childhood, but in my job I have to be neutral, so.
Yeah. Now, you say in one article that people kind of know it, but it doesn't affect your objectivity.
No, it shouldn't, or else I wouldn't have the job.
Exactly. Now, you also played some baseball in college.
Yeah, 1975 at Lehman. I played 1 year in Division III, and then after that, 10 years in the Bronx Sandlots.
And which honed your skills more?
The Sandlots. There were more games.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Now, you have to really have a thick skin to be an official scorer, don't you?
Yeah, that's kind of the reputation we got because you get a lot of inquiries, let's put it that way.
Second guessing.
That's part of it. Comes with the territory.
Yeah, so you're used to that. Howie, will congratulate him. Just did his 1,000th Major League game as an official scorer. And how many years does that take you back, Howie?
This is my 18th season.
Oh, amazing. And what kind of plays, do you have any plays that stand out in your mind?
You mean over the years?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, there was that pop-up with Jeter and A-Rod about 10 years ago that got a lot of attention.
Yeah.
I was a scorer on that play, and that got, you know, got my name in every paper in the country. There's been some, you know, there's been some notable games I've worked. I did the final game in Montreal Expos franchise history because that was at Shea. I did the last game at Shea in 2008.
Uh-huh.
I've done a game that ended on an unassisted triple play, as Met fans will remember, and I've scored two unassisted triple plays in my scoring career. So,
right.
you know, some notable memories.
Now, getting back to that Jeter play, Howie, we've got Howie Carpin with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Derek wanted you to take a look at the tape again.
Yeah, but what happened was I did not know that Brian Cashman had said something to Derek about his attitude with A-Rod during that time period, because that was the height of their feud, so to speak. And Derek apparently gave him, like, the cold shoulder after that play on the field, and it really took notice. So when he was talking to me about the call, which he rarely did, to be honest with you, to be fair, he never really complained about a call except for that one. But when he talked to me, two times after the game, I said to him, look at the video, and I didn't realize Brian Cashman had told him, look at the video to see your attitude. I told him, look at the video to see why he got the error, because he moved in behind A-Rod, and he kind of, like, prevented him from making the catch. So when that happens in scoring lexicon, the guy who causes the person to miss it gets the E.
Yeah, and he didn't like that.
Not on that one for some reason.
Probably because it involved A-Rod.
Yeah, I would think so. That's what everybody's speculating.
Now, another play that I read about that got you a little bit of attention was in 2004, Tony Clark was on the Yankees. He hit a ground ball to David Ortiz that went through the webbing in Big Poppy's mitt.
Yeah, you've done your homework. Yeah, that was a good one. That, the Yankees wanted a hit for Tony Clark on what Don Mattingly, who was the hitting coach, referred to as equipment malfunction. So I was kind of called down to the manager's office for a little powwow, and I don't know if you know people listen to your show. Remember the old the Munster show? Herman Munster tried out for the Dodgers, hit a ball through the guy's mitt like it burned a hole in the glove. So I kind of said to Joe Torre, yeah, Herman Munster didn't hit that ball, and he started laughing. He said, get the hell out of here.
So he got it. Yeah,
he got it, and then it was never changed.
That was the episode with Leo DeRocher.
Yeah. They said he'd knock down the scoreboard, cost him $10,000 a game.
Exactly, yeah. Seeing Fred Gwynn in that uniform, that was unbelievable. Yeah,
yeah, that's my favorite one.
That's a great one. Now, there was also a situation, Howie. Manny Ramirez is chasing Hack Wilson for the single-season RBI record. You gave him an error on the play, and he didn't like it either.
Well, that was the one he was the batter, and bases loaded, and Jose Canseco was in right field, if it's the correct one I'm thinking of, and he just let a ball drop in right by his feet that he never tried to play it. And so as a scorer, if you feel an outfielder just doesn't try to play a ball, you can charge an error on that, and I did. And he didn't get any RBIs on that one. So, you know, if his RBI total is three short because of me, so be it.
Exactly. Now, you mentioned Jeter, and then he wasn't a constant complainer. Even during his pursuit of the 3,000 hits, nothing ever came up with Derek?
No.
No, okay.
Well, came up more with the media guys.
Yeah.
Thought the scorers were favoring him so he could get the hit at home.
Oh, okay.
Which was totally,
yeah.
Totally off base.
Would you ever, Howie, change a call based on complaints from people?
Not based on complaints, based on evidence.
Okay.
Now they have an appeal system, so we don't even, you know, it's out of our hands after a while.
Exactly. We're speaking with Howie Carpen tonight on Sports Talk 1240. Let's get to the book. The latest book you wrote with Mark Roseman is entitled Down on the Corner, Ralph Kiner and Kiner's Corner. What made you decide to write this book now, Howie?
Well, Mark and I did a hockey book, and he was going through some of his old mementos, and he found some Betamax tapes that had the show.
Oh, boy.
So he said he proposed the idea to me, and then we went with it, and you know, we interviewed like 32 guests who were on the shows from the past and tried to call people behind the scenes that worked on the show and got a lot of interesting and original stories, as I'm sure you've seen.
Yes.
So it was a blast writing it. Even though I grew up a Yankee fan, I watched Kiner's Corner. You know, I watched the Mets. I mean, you grew up either one, you watched the other one in those days.
Yeah, that's the way it was in those days. There wasn't the big rivalry. There was a rivalry, but it wasn't like it is today.
No, we all watched out of curiosity
right.
The other team. So it was cool. You got two teams in town, and then, you know, there was actually a Red Barber show on the Yankee broadcast for a while. I think they tried to copy Kiner's Corner, but it didn't last too long. And then, you know, to be honest with you, I wanted to see some of the visiting players when he brought them on, because they were just like figures on a screen. And when he brought them on, they became like real human beings.
You really got to know them, exactly. Willie Mays, right. Roberto Clemente, and the way I opened the show was to all you fathers out there, happy birthday.
Right.
Ralph actually said that.
Yeah, that's one of his best lines.
Yeah, that's a great one. Yeah. Now, Kiner's Corner at the Polo Grounds. Give us a little insight into what that was like.
Well, obviously the clubhouse was in center field, so it posed some logistical problems. As Joe Gallagher, the original producer, said on the first show, they tried to get Musial after that opening game, and he was already in the shower, and then Red Shandies came running in from center field to be on the show as a guest. And then they tried to do some clinics like the old Dodger broadcast, the Happy Felton Gang, and
where they
ran clinics for kids. They tried that a little bit. You know, Ralph would be upstairs, and then the personal player would be on the field. So they tried different things. But one thing Ralph stressed, he wanted to be down the middle. He didn't want to be a homer. They knew the Mets were going to lose a lot of games in those days. It wasn't like today where you get an expansion team and they're a good team in 2 years.
Right.
It didn't happen like that. It took like 5-10 years for a team to get good. And when the Mets did in 69, that was their seventh year, eighth year in baseball. So,
and that was fast.
So they knew the Mets would be losers. They wouldn't get a lot of them on as winners. So Ralph wanted to be down the middle so he would get the star of the game no matter what.
Exactly. Now, a lot of the players, the visiting players especially, Howie, I recall in the book Tim Harkness saying they really had no idea of the impact that a guy like Ralph Kiner had on the game of baseball before he became that host of Kiner's Corner.
Yeah. No. Well, you know, you didn't have the access you have today.
Right.
That's for sure. And, you know, a lot of guys never really saw games before they were even in the major leagues. And then when they saw themselves on Kiner's Corner, they actually saw themselves on video for the first time. So it was all new, which made it, like, kind of special because it was pure. It wasn't tarnished, you know, with all the stuff they have today. They put 45 things on your screen and have all these stupid statistics, but that's another story. But anyway, it was pure. It was simple in those days.
Definitely. No frills. Didn't the set fall down at one point?
Yeah, Casey had the mic on, and apparently he would talk so much, they would let him keep talking, and they'd go to a commercial break and then come back, and he'd still be talking. But one time he got up before the mic was taken off, and he yanked the whole set down when he got up off his chair, which is kind of made for quite a scene.
Unbelievable. Live TV at its finest.
Now, yeah.
Ralph said, one of his quotes, "The Mets hired me because they looked at my background with the Pirates and saw that I had losing experience."
Yeah, that was the title of the first chapter. That was where we introduced Ralph and, you know, obviously touched on his career a little and then, you know, how he got into broadcasting. It was my idea. I wanted to title the chapters with something he said, which I thought made for a nice effect. And, yeah, that was the opening chapter with the history of how he got into broadcasting.
Yeah, give us a little rundown on how Ralph exactly got into the business.
Well, when he played for the Pirates, Bing Crosby was one of the owners.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So Ralph kind of mingled with celebrities off the field, so he was kind of used to it. And then Bing must have saw something in him because he allowed him to work on his golf tournament. The telecast in, they saw he was a pretty good interviewer. Then he got a job, I think, in the minors, because Hank Greenberg, his friend, was the GM of this minor league team. He was broadcasting, I think, the White Sox in the minor leagues, and then the Mets brought him in. You know, he was Ralph Kiner, who was a National League guy, and they already had two professional announcers, and Bob Murphy and Lindsey Nelson already did major league games. They thought Ralph would be a nice, you know, round out for that crew, and they were right.
One of the great quotes, and it's the title of Chapter 5, Howie, has to do with Choo Choo Coleman. When Ralph asks, "What's your wife's name and what's she like?" And what does Choo Choo say?
"Yeah, her name is Mrs. Coleman and she likes me, Bob," I think was the quote. there was story. He said he never said that, if you keep reading his dialogue there.
Yeah.
Although many people will tell you that he did, so. Which made for an interesting, it was almost like a guy on the grassy knoll type of thing, you know?
Yeah. Now, people may not realize these guys were compensated, but just like the salaries back then, it wasn't much.
Yeah, I mean, Keith Hernandez told me, like, in later years, in the 80s, like, Ralph handed him a $100 bill before he even sat down. But it was mostly gift certificates and, you know, they gave you gas things and restaurants and stuff that, from the local establishments. Maybe they got a watch later on. But, yeah, it was an interesting array of gifts that were given out.
One of the guys even relates that they gave out green stamps.
Yeah, that was a big deal in those days. you cash them in.
They said the end of the year, the guys would go get washers, dryers.
Right. And then there's the Budding story where Budding wanted something, and they're only going to give him a gift certificate, and he almost didn't go on with Ralph after his perfect game.
Oh, man. Yeah, I can see that
on
happening.
Father's Day, June 21st that year.
Exactly. Now, Ralph also hobnobbed with some pretty famous women in Hollywood. And I believe you touch on that in Chapter 6 with Jamie Lee Curtis coming up to Ralph.
Yeah, that's a famous story. Ralph, dated, like, Elizabeth Taylor and a bunch of starlets in those days.
Janet Lee.
That's the story. When Jamie Lee came to the press box in Philadelphia one day to say hello, because they were friendly with Chris Wheeler, the Philly announcer, Ralph always wanted to meet her. And then when she was introduced to him, she said, Ralph said, I went out with your mother, and then she hugged him, and she said, Daddy.
Yeah. That must have went over real big with Ralph.
Oh, boy. Yeah, that was something.
Now, what's some of your favorite stories from the book, Howie?
Well, the Bunning story is one, and then there's the Rico Cardi story where he had a brawl with the Mets in the first game of a doubleheader. Got into it with, like, Frank Larry, I think, was the pitcher. Larry Benoit was the player rep in that day.
Yeah.
And he never got thrown out. And then he ended up with, like, seven hits, and they swept the doubleheader, and Ralph wanted him on the show. So they got him on the show, and the studio was right near the clubhouse. So they didn't really need a TV. They could know what was going on without a television in there. And the Mets were not happy that they brought Cardi on. Larry Benoit went into the control room and got mad and said, why is he on the show? And then the producer said, well, he had seven hits.
Yeah.
You know, and he was the star of the game. And Larry Benoit stormed out, never talked to the producer or Ralph after that ever.
Wow. That's something.
And that's one story. And the Bunning story is another one. And the Koufax no-hitter against the Mets at Dodger Stadium in 62. Ralph was downstairs, and he wanted to get Koufax on the, you know, for Kiner's corner. And the Dodger announcer was also down there, Jerry Doggett, the radio guy, and he let Ralph take Koufax first, even though Ralph was the visiting broadcast.
Great story,
I found that kind of interesting, and that was tremendous. And then there's the 23-inning game where Ralph ended up staying down there all those innings, and he went down like the eighth, and then he stayed down there like 15 innings, and the producer regretted that, said that it was his one regret that he kept Ralph down there, because they never thought the game would go that long. They thought the Mets would lose eventually, and they did. They didn't for so long. And then they tried to get Galen Sisko on the air on that, you know, Kiner's corner at the end, because they're having trouble, I think, getting a, I don't know if they got a giant, but Galen Sisko was so upset he didn't even want to go on the show.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, some good ones. What do you think makes Ralph such an enduring legend to Mets fans, Howie?
Well, you know the history of baseball around here. I mean, we take our baseball seriously.
Right.
Ralph was a big part of the fabric of the Mets from 62 to, you know, till he passed 2 years ago. He was one of the original voices. He was a National League. He's a Hall of Fame player. He left quite a legacy, and he treated people all the same. He didn't really, you know, judge people by their status or stuff like that, and he made people feel comfortable around him when he was in their presence. So I think that was a big part of it.
He really did. Now, you have any new projects you're going to be working on, Howie?
I may have a book or two coming up. Nothing really substantial.
Okay. Nothing you want to tell us about?
I can't right now.
I got you. All right. Well, Howie, it's been a real pleasure having you with us tonight. I thank you for taking the time out of your Father's Day Sunday night to be with us. The book, folks, great stories on the legendary Kiner's Corner, Down on the Corner, Ralph Kiner and Kiner's Corner. Get it on Amazon. Get it at Barnes & Noble, Book Review, your local bookstore. Mark Rosenman, Howie Carpin. Howie Carpin, thanks for being with us.
Thanks, Bill. Anytime.
Take care. Howie Carpin, you ladies too. And gentlemen. We'll be right back after this commercial word, folks. Stick around.
What's your favorite color? Tell us, please.
Kids will spend 20 minutes listening to songs like this.
What's your favorite color?
How about 2 minutes to brush their teeth? Brushing for 2 minutes now can save your child from severe tooth pain later. For fun 2-minute videos to watch while brushing, visit 2min2x.org. 2 minutes, twice a day. Pay at the time. A message from the Partnership for Healthy Mouths, Healthy Lives, and the Ad Council.
How's it going?
I'm having a stroke.
Are you going to shake my hand?
I'm having a stroke.
Wow, you're not even moving your arm.
I'm having a stroke.
When someone is having a stroke, they may not be able to say it with words, but their body language will tell you loud and clear. Look for FAST. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911 immediately. Know the sudden signs. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Do you have a business or product you want to tell the world about? Do you think you're the next great DJ, humor show host, or serious commentator? If so, WGBB is the place for you. We have the airtime and know-how to promote your business, sell your product, push your ideas, or showcase your talent. We are a multicultural radio station with both hour and half-hour time slots available to the public and an experienced, knowledgeable staff to help you put on the greatest radio program possible at rates to fit every budget. Call 1-516-623-1240. That's 1-516-623-1240 and ask for Jeff or Trevor and take the first steps to let the world know about your business, product, ideas, or to become the next radio star. That's 1-516-623-1240 for WGBB, the station that serves your community and you.
All right, folks, we're back on Sports Talk 1240. Father's Day show had John Kinsella, Dwyer Brown with us, talking a little bit about fathers and the impact that Field of Dreams had on many people and their fathers. If you'd like to give us a call, do so at 631-888-8811. Discuss anything. We had Howie Carpin with us to discuss Kiner's Corner, the legendary postgame show of the New York Mets for many, many years. Some great stories in that book. Pick it up if you can. If you're on the webcam, I have it showing right now. You can see the cover. Pick up the book. Some wonderful stories. I'd like to talk a little bit further quickly about Sol White and the Argyle Hotel. Sol White was a forgotten man who played in a segregated league. After he died in Central Islip in 1955, his remains were buried in an unmarked pauper's grave on Staten Island. White emerged from obscurity 51 years later when he was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2006. Sol White not only was a central figure at the dawn of Negro League baseball, a game rich with talented players who were denied access to the mainstream of America's game, but he was also a member of what is believed to be the first professional African-American team formed in Babylon Village on Long Island's South Shore. In a career that started in 1887 and ran through 1926, White was an infielder, manager, and executive who chronicled history. He nearly became lost in it, but his past finally was recognized after a special Negro League committee was formed by the Cooperstown Shrine in 2001 to research deserving candidates whose legend did not rise to the likes of the previously inducted Satchel Paige or Josh Gibson. When he died in 1959, everything that we knew about him was secondary, said Larry Lester, a historian and co-founder of the Negro League's Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri, and so his chances of going into Cooperstown were very slim. There was also something of a treasure trove waiting to be unearthed about White and his contributions on and off the field. He spent 40 years in baseball, and in 1907 chronicled the black players of his time in Sol White's official baseball guide. When his book came out, it was considered the Bible at that time of black baseball, Lester said. We learned so much from that book. He identified many of the ball players that we had no record of. It was the Holy Grail, the Rosetta Stone of 19th century baseball. It was all right there in one book. White, who went to Cooperstown as an executive, participated in the history he had written about. The first professional black team originated in 1885 at the site of the Argyle Hotel in Babylon Village. The hotel was situated at the northwest corner of Argyle Lake, according to Babylon Town historian Mary Cascone. The field where the team played was commemorated with a plaque in 2010. Stories differ on how the team originated, but White himself wrote that it came about when the head waiter at the Argyle, which was a summer destination on the Long Island Railroad for visitors from New York City, first recruited interested employees. It later expanded to other areas. The team was called the Cuban Giants. White wrote in 1938 that the team passed as foreigners, Cubans, as they finally decided, hoping to conceal the fact that they were just American Negro hotel waiters and talked a gibberish to each other on the field, which they hoped sounded like Spanish. It is not known whether White, who was born in Ohio, joined the team, but he was on the club in 1888 when it won its second straight, so named, World Colored Championship. By that time, the team had moved to Trenton, New Jersey. White participated as a manager in the Negro Leagues from 1920 to 1926. When he left baseball, he wrote for the New York Amsterdam News and the New York Age. In reference to African Americans playing in the majors someday, White wrote, "Someday the bar will drop and some of the good men will be chosen from out of the colored profession and will be a credit to all and pave the way for others to follow." White was 78 when a young former Negro leaguer named Jackie Robinson broke the color line in 1947. White may very well have been among the last group of Negro League participants to enter Cooperstown. We hope not, but I hope the Hall of Fame reconsiders and continues to investigate these great men who played baseball before the color line was broken by Jackie Robinson. That'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Dwyer Brown and Howie Carpen, my engineer, Brian Graves, and most of all, you, for joining us on this Father's Day. Stay tuned for hour number two with Andrew Claudio on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you on Sunday night, July 3rd. Till then, Bill Donahue, wishing you a good evening, folks.
In the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.